Lecture 10, The New Testament.
In our last lecture, we looked at the Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the important religious documents of the Hindus. This time we will look at the supreme religious document of the Christians, the New Testament. As with the Bhagavad Gita, the focus of this lecture, because the focus of the book, will be on the relationship between God and human beings. The Christian New Testament was written in the first century in Greek, which had been the international language for around the Mediterranean ever since the conquest of Alexander the Great. Jesus and his disciples would have spoken Aramaic, but clearly Paul, who wrote the first books of the New Testament, and the other writers in the New Testament knew Greek, which allowed the book to be disseminated beyond the borders of the world where the events transpired. For the Christians, this is the new covenant, which either transcends or fulfills the old one, which was made with the Hebrews. At the heart of the new covenant is the idea that Jesus died a blameless death for the sins of the world, thus undoing the primal sin of Adam and Eve and reconciling gods and humans. His resurrection both validates that sacrifice and establishes a pattern which Christians can participate in. By believing in Jesus as the Son of God, Christians believe that they can appropriate his death and his resurrection. And in addition, the new covenant this time is made not just with the Hebrews, but with all people. All peoples from here on are God's chosen people. This was, at any rate, the message of Paul, the first Christian missionary, the first great Christian missionary whose journeys are reported in the book of Acts, and who wrote what most scholars think are the oldest books in the Old Testament, the letters to various churches dating from the 50s sometime, which would have put them about 20-some years after Jesus' death. Paul was writing to Gentiles, that is to non-Jews, who would not have known the Old Testament, and so they would not have known what to do with the prophetic testimonies of the coming Messiah that are given in the Old Testament. So Paul explains Jesus' death and resurrection in terms of mystery religions, which had sprung up all over the Mediterranean world by the first century. The mystery religions were personal alternatives to the kind of official and public state religion of Rome. Official religion in Rome was a kind of function of the state, and to participate in the official religion was a kind of duty. Robert Payne, who in a book called Ancient Rome, said, "The idea of a Roman state religion was to observe the proper rituals so that you would get the gods to bless the state, preserve the peace, and that made religious duties something like paying one's taxes or having children or fighting in the military. It was probably no more or less important than any of those other things." And the Roman religion also, as we've seen in the past, offered very little by way of moral code. We've seen that in the Homeric epics and in the Aeneid. The gods pretty much do their own thing, and the humans have to invent their own morality, and there is no promise of personal immortality in that state religion. So these mystery cults sprang up all over the Mediterranean world, dedicated to various gods, to Isis, to Dionysus, to Mithra. They were called mysteries because their rites were secret, were available only to initiates. The most popular one in Rome was dedicated to the god Mithra, who had been imported from Persia. And that Mithraism involved some ritual. It was killing a bull and then bathing in the blood of the bull. And in some of these mystery religions, there was also a sacred meal, although there were a lot of variations from one religion to another. But all of these mystery religions appealed to the individual, not to the state. And all of them promised that by participating in the death and rebirth of a god who died and was reborn annually, the individual could achieve immortality. So the people who read Paul's letters would have known about these cults. Perhaps some of them might have even belonged to one or more of them, so that Paul could use that knowledge to declare that Jesus was the fulfillment of all other mystery religions. For Paul, Jesus fulfilled other mystery religions in that he was a god who wasn't from mythology, who didn't die annually, but who had actually died once at a particular point in history, and who had died once and for all, and whose death and resurrection via belief and participation in the rituals of baptism and the sacred meal, the Eucharist, could promise immortality to the individual. Christianity, thanks to its roots in Judaism, also came with a well-developed morality, which was useful because it helped decide what you should do in the hustle and bustle and the hurly and burly of everyday life. Anyway, because of his emphasis, Paul was less interested in Jesus' life and teachings than in his death and resurrection. That was the important thing for Paul. If you're interested in Pauline theology, probably the best place to study it is the book of Romans. Paul had not founded the church in Rome, and so he was being very careful when he explained to the Romans how belief in Jesus worked and what it meant. In some of the other letters, he had actually founded the churches, and he could assume that people would remember what he told them, and so that he could take a shortcut here and there. Romans is probably the most complete and explicit statement of his theology. The Gospels were written perhaps 10 or 15 or 20 years later than Paul's letters. The Gospel of John, it's thought, may have been written much, much later, perhaps at the end of the first century, even in the first decade of the second century. And they add to Paul's account of Jesus' death and resurrection a lot of information about his life and teachings. As to why they were written, when they were written, a current theory has it that most of the followers of Jesus, including Paul, seem to have believed that the second coming was going to happen very quickly after Jesus left. And so, given that, there was really no reason to write things down. But by the time you got to the 60s, some of the people who remembered Jesus, who had been his disciples, were actually beginning to die. And then it seemed important to write this down so that you could pass it on to the next generation. The Gospels, like Paul's letters, place a great importance on the death and resurrection, but they also have a lot more material about his life and his teachings. The oldest and the shortest gospel is Mark's. Matthew and Luke seem to have used Mark as their source, but they seem to have had other sources since they include material which is not in Mark. And Luke includes material which isn't in either Mark or Matthew, so he seems to have had access to another source or a series of sources than the other ones. These three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are called the Synoptic Gospels, since their accounts, while they differ in some detail, can be reconciled with each other. You can make a kind of coherent story out of them. Matthew and Luke have slightly different versions of the Christmas story. All three of them tell of the baptism by John the Baptist, and then several years of ministry and teaching and miracles. And all three of them then tell of the trial and the crucifixion and the resurrection. Luke has the ascension into heaven. Mark simply says that he was received back into heaven, and Matthew ends with a great commission to go and make disciples of all nations. John's gospel, the fourth one, is very different from the other three. He shares only a few events with the others, although the trial and the crucifixion and the resurrection is essentially the same in John as it is in the other three. And he includes a lot of material that the others don't use. He's also deeply indebted to Greek philosophy in the way that the other three synoptic gospels are not. That very famous first sentence, that great resonant sentence in the first sentence of the Gospel of John says, "In the beginning was the word, N-R-K-H-O-Logos." And logos came, that word came with a huge resonance from Greek philosophical discourse. So John already announces in that very first sentence that this is going to be a book which is going to embed the life and teachings of Jesus into a Greek philosophical context. In John, Jesus talks about himself a lot more than he does in the other Gospels. Typically, he starts a long monologue by saying something like, "I am the good shepherd, I am the light of the world, I am the vine, I am the door." Humphrey Carpenter says in his book about Jesus that the Gospel of John is really more a meditation or spiritual reflection on Jesus than it is a history. Christian theology actually owes more to John than it does to the other Gospels, but it contains less about the historical figure than the other three do. And so for the rest of this hour, we'll just sort of set John aside, regretfully, but to focus on the Synoptic Gospels. The differences in the Synoptic Gospels can probably be accounted for by their different aims and audiences. Mark's was designed probably to get as much information about Jesus into writing as they could before those who remembered him died. The central question that Mark asks throughout his gospel is about Jesus' identity. Who was this Jesus? Who is this guy? And its answer is that he was the awaited Jewish Messiah. In the very first verse of Mark, Mark says that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Not only does he say he's the Son of God, but he says he's the Christ. The Greek word is Christos, and Christos is the Greek word for Messiah. So that from the very outset, the very first sentence, Mark said, who was this man? He was the Messiah. He was the Son of God. And in Mark, when the Jewish high priest at Jesus' trial, when he asks him who he is, he said, are you the Christ? Jesus simply says, I am. Matthew's gospel was written for fellow Jews, and his intent is to show that Jesus fulfilled all the Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah, or at least as many of the prophecies as Matthew can work in. His gospel is dense with allusions to the Old Testament. He reminds us a lot of the way Virgil uses Homer, except that Virgil always lets us figure them out for ourselves, whereas Matthew almost always tips us off that he's quoting something from the Old Testament. He usually says, so that the scriptures might be fulfilled, or as it is written, or some such thing to tell us that he's now making a reference to the Old Testament. When we read Matthew, we really do need a reference Bible, because all of those added allusions from the Old Testament give additional resonances for the things that Matthew says about Jesus in the New Testament. I just picked a chapter more or less at random. I wound up with the 26th chapter of Matthew. In the last 61 verses of the 26th chapter of Matthew, there are, as I counted them, 25 references to the Old Testament. So this is very densely rich with allusions to the Old Testament. Matthew also seems to include some narrative details that are designed to call his Jewish readers' attention to parts of the Old Testament story. He's the only one, for example, who has Mary and Joseph taking the baby Jesus down into Egypt when, according to the story, Herod was killing off all the children, all the male children under 2 years old, in the hopes of killing this Jesus, whom he had heard was going to be a king, and he was worried about the threat that might make to his own kingship. And of course, that trip into Egypt sets up some interesting parallels between Jesus and Moses, and makes Moses into a kind of type of Jesus. Moses was the one who was going to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt, and the trip to Egypt sets up that kind of resonance. It also recalls the story about Herod killing all the children under 2 years old, reminds us that part of that Moses story is that the Pharaoh had ordered the killing of all the firstborn sons of the captive of Hebrews. Matthew also makes a point of noting that Jesus spent 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, which perhaps is designed to recall the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness before entering into the Promised Land with Moses. And so, anyway, the target audiences, therefore, may have had a great deal to do with why and how the books get written and some of the differences between them. It isn't that they're disagreeing about details, it's just that they're focusing on and emphasizing different things. Some things the synoptics do agree on, and one of them is that Jesus preferred to teach in parables, which answer questions not discursively and directly, but usually with a story. It's another one of the ways that John is kind of the odd gospel out. His Jesus doesn't use parables, he uses metaphors, and he usually speaks in long kind of discursive monologues explaining his role as ambassador from God. In the synoptics, you have a lot of good stories which start out, Jesus will start out by saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who, and then the parable gets launched. Mark says that Jesus taught many things in parables. In fact, Mark says he hardly taught anything outside of parables. And then Mark, when he says that, has Jesus tell the parable of the sower, of a candle hidden under a bushel, and of the mustard seed to sort of illustrate his point. After he has Jesus tell these stories, Mark says this, with many such parables he spoke the word to them as they were able to hear it. He did not speak to them except in parables, but he explained everything in private to his disciples. That's been a troublesome little passage down through history. Parables, as we've seen in those of Zhuang Zhou, are more resonant than discursive answers. That is, they require a little more from the hearers, and sometimes they're capable of more than one understanding. Mark's comment that Jesus told parables in public and that people heard them and understood them as they were able is no doubt true. But then he says that Jesus took his disciples aside and told them privately what the real meaning was of these parables. And of course, that's given rise to a huge, long tradition that there has always been some kind of secret group that understands these parables, who knows these truths that were not ever made public. And there have been groups down through all of history that have run parallel with the history of the Christian church, in fact, They've included over time the Gnostics in the New Testament and perhaps the Knights Templar, all the way down to that cult in Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, which also believes that they have a secret that nobody else knows about. Fortunately for us, most of Jesus' parables do not seem to need secret interpretation. Many of them, like the prodigal son, or the man who loses one sheep out of 100, or the woman who loses one piece of silver out of 10, are designed simply to show God's concern for the lowly, the lost, the exception, the outcast. The prodigal son is a famous story, and we all know this one. It's about the younger son who says, since I'm going to get half of this, your estate anyway, why don't I take it now? And so his father gives him his half of the inheritance, and he takes it off and he wastes it. He goes through it really fast, and when he is totally hungry and bedraggled and worked over and he's gone through and he's broke, he comes struggling home and he says to his dad, could I just have a job? Give me the lowliest, crummiest job on the farm and I'll take it. And the father is so happy that he invites all his neighbors, kills the fatted calf, and throws a great party for this younger son. The older son, in the meantime, has been staying home and has done all the work on the farm, has been a good, loyal son. And he's a little miffed because he says, I've been home, I've been doing this work, I've been doing your duty, I've never disobeyed you, I haven't gone through any of your inheritance, and you've never thrown a big party for me. And the father's answer is this. He says, but we had to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found. Then Jesus immediately later tells another story which has the same point. A man has 100 sheep, and one of them gets lost, and so he leaves the 99, the majority of the flock, he leaves them in the wilderness to fend for themselves while he goes out looking for that one sheep. And when he finds the one sheep and brings it back, he too invites all his neighbors in, and they have a party. A woman who has 10 pieces of silver loses a piece of silver, and she spends a lot of time letting the other 10 pieces of silver take care of themselves while she goes out with candle and broom until she finds that piece of silver. And when she finds it, she invites her neighbors in and they have a big party. It's the point is, after all of these parables, all of which make sort of the same point, Jesus explains to all of us the meaning of those parables. He says, just so I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. In our course, this is a strikingly new idea, since in most of the theologies that we've looked at, God or the gods favor the strong, the beautiful, the successful. They favor those people who are most like them. When Achilles withdraws from battle, he gets his mother, who's a goddess, Thetis, to get Zeus to agree to help the Trojans while he's sitting out the battle. Zeus does, but we have the feeling that his help is not superfluous, but at least it's bringing coals to Newcastle, because with Achilles sitting out, the Achaeans are going to get defeated anyway. So this is simply validating something that's already going to happen. Odysseus gets help from Athena on the way home because he really doesn't need it, because he's going to get home without her anyway. And even more tellingly, perhaps, when two heroes face off in Homer, they have equal weapons, they have equal skill, they live by the same code. When they face off, one of them goes away covered in glory, the other dies. Homer almost always assumes that the one who won got help from a god or goddess. And what that means is that, once again, it reaffirms this connection between success and the care of the gods. The gods take care of the successful. The gods are on the sides of the successful. And Roman stories, I think, that we have seen in the Aeneid tend to reinforce this same pattern. The gods care for the successful. The successful are successful because the gods help them. We have had some exceptions to this in this course so far. The Hebrew Bible has some really remarkable exceptions. Yahweh will take someone like Moses and turn him into the greatest hero in Hebrew history. Moses, we remember at the beginning of the story, says, don't pick me. I stammer. I'm not going to be able to stand up and talk to Pharaoh. And God says, you just do what I tell you to, and I'll be with you, and you won't stammer when you talk to Pharaoh. David is out tending sheep, remember, in the story when Samuel comes out to pick the next king of Israel. David is out tending sheep, and he's the youngest, the least likely. And God has been able to take unlikely people in the Old Testament and turn them into great heroes. And there is a concern for the poor in the Old Testament that runs all the way through the Old Testament. Hosea and Amos, for example, spend most of their lives denouncing Israel for not taking better care of the poor. And in the Bhagavad Gita, we've had at least theoretically the possibility for this to happen. When we remember Krishna says to Arjuna, he says, anybody who dedicates his actions to me is going to be dear to me. And it doesn't make any difference who that is. Anybody from any caste, if you sacrifice the actions of your life to me, I will love you. However, even with those exceptions in mind, the idea that God is especially concerned for the lost, the straggler, the ordinary, is underscored by all of the Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount. Who are the blessed? Who are those who are going to inherit the kingdom of heaven? They turn out to be the poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, and those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. How many of those values would Achilles have endorsed? How many would Odysseus have endorsed? Now, we have moved into a world in which it would seem as though ordinary values are being, in a revolutionary way, are being reversed. Typically, when Matthew reports these Beatitudes in the New Testament, he sees them as a fulfillment of an Old Testament prophecy from the book of Isaiah. And this is the passage that he has in mind. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and release to the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn. And what is clearly being announced here in both the Isaiah passage and the Matthew passage from the Sermon on the Mount is a radically new age in which the accepted values of the world are going to be turned upside down. The new favored man of God is going to be the poor, who's uncompromised by wealth and worldly accommodations, and whose sole concern is for righteousness. This new emphasis has powerful implications for the future of literature. Eric Auerbach, in his great book, Mimesis, argues that there had never been a serious treatment of common people in literature. If they appear at all, if common people appear at all, they're treated comically. Thersites is treated that way in the Iliad. He's the only commoner who appears in that whole poem. The messengers in Greek tragedy are treated as sometimes as buffoons, people who make mistakes, who are kind of comic figures. All of the characters in Aristophanes are treated as comic characters. So that what Auerbach says is there is nothing in all of classical literature like the story of the denial of Jesus by Peter in Matthew in the New Testament. The story is that Jesus, before he's betrayed, tells Peter that before the cock crows, you will deny me three times. Peter says, no, of course, I won't. I'll go to the death with you. And then in the bustle of that night and the scary things that happen and Jesus gets hauled into trial, and all kinds of terrible things happen. And Peter, before he quite realizes even what he's doing, hears himself say three times, I do not even know the man. And then the cock crows. And the story tells us Peter went out and wept bitterly. As Auerbach says, nothing like this has ever happened in literature before. The two passages that Auerbach spends talking about this passage go like this. A scene like Peter's denial fits into no antique genre. It is too serious for comedy, too contemporary and everyday for tragedy, politically too insignificant for history, and the form which was given it is one of such immediacy that its like does not exist in the literature of antiquity. A few pages later, he adds this. The story of Peter completely destroys the aesthetics of the separation of styles. It engenders a new elevated style which does not scorn everyday life and which is ready to absorb the sensorially realistic, even the ugly, the undignified, the physically base. Or, if one prefers to have it the other way around, a new sermo humilis is born, a low style, such as would properly only be applicable to comedy, but which now reaches out far beyond its original domain and encroaches upon the deepest and the highest, the sublime and the eternal. This means, as Auerbach points out, that after the New Testament, it will be possible in literature to treat fishermen and prostitutes and tax collectors and the sick and the paralyzed and the lame and the lost and the erring and people like Peter who aim way too high and then fall as far as it's possible for someone to fall, and to treat them all in serious literature, to treat them as serious characters in serious literature. In literary terms, this may be the greatest revolution brought about by the New Testament. It isn't going to happen overnight. It will be quite a while yet before kings and aristocrats are replaced as the subject of literature and replaced by ordinary people. But the seeds of that serious revolution in literature are planted here, and we will see them bear fruit down through the rest of our course. In our next program, our next lecture, we will be back one more time to epics and heroes. This time we will be looking at the Germanic epic poem Beowulf, brought to England by those same peoples, those Germanic northern peoples, who, as the Roman Empire was collapsing, poured over the old borders of the Roman Empire, poured into Europe, and became the modern Europeans. As we will see, there are going to be many, many similarities between the Germanic epic and the epics we have looked at in the past. There will be many, many serious similarities between the character of Beowulf and the protagonist of the epic poems we've done in the past. But, and this is a really important but, and it's appropriate that it comes when it does, this will be the first epic poem that we will do in this course which will have been touched by Christianity. One of the things that everyone notices about this poem is that its origins are in a purely pagan world, but by the time it gets written down, it is written down by someone who is a Christian, which means that there are bits and pieces of Christian thought that get into this poem in a way that has been very, very troublesome for people down through history. The first question is, what happens to an epic like Beowulf when it becomes Christianized? Is it in fact Christianized? Do the bits of Christianity that show up in here, do they significantly change the poem in enough ways that we have to think about it in different kinds of terms? What we'll do when we look at Beowulf next time is we're actually going to consider that question, and we're going to ask the question, if you take a poem, take the Iliad and the Odyssey, if you took the Iliad and the Odyssey, for example, and then added bits of Christian theology around the edges, what would happen to it? What would happen to the epic hero? What would become of the ethos of the poem? What would happen to all of the heroic codes that these poems are about? That's sort of what happens with Beowulf. And in our next lecture, we'll ask the question about, first of all, identifying those bits of Christianity that show up for the first time in history in an epic poem. And then secondly, to ask, given those bits of Christianity in that poem, what do they do to the poem? What do we do with them in the poem? And how do we read that poem with or without the Christianity which has been now added to it? That's our next lecture.